Hello, and welcome to the Asian Peace Talks. I'm Kishore Mahbubani. The Asian Peace Talks is a podcast series launched by the Asian Peace Program of the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore. The goal of the Asian Peace Program is a noble one, to try and preserve and strengthen peace in Asia. With our limited resources, we have to take a modest approach. Nonetheless, just as a small acupuncture needle can make a big difference, we hope that our monthly policy essays and this podcast series will make a difference and strengthen the peace regimes in Asia. I'm Kishore Mahbubani, the host of the Asian Peace Talks. For the 8th episode of this podcast series, we are delighted to interview a good friend, Girija Pandey, the chairman of Apex Avalon Consulting Singapore, and he also chairs the Swiss cost chain IQAG's Asia operation. Hope I got that right. He's the former president of Tata Consulting Services Asia Pacific, where he built businesses in 14 APEC countries, including a very successful joint venture with the Chinese government in technology. He serves on many global tech and healthcare boards and has won many awards, including the National Public Service Medal from the President of Singapore. Girija Pandey is also the author of the acclaimed book, The Silk Road, The Rediscovered, How Indian and Chinese Companies Are Becoming Globally Stronger by Winning in Each Other's Markets. He has also been serving on the Confederation of Indian Industries China Indian Group for many years. Indeed, our topic for today is the economic relationship between China, which is today the world's second largest economy, and India, the world's fifth largest economy. Indeed, our discussion today, if it goes well, should give us a very good glimpse of how the 21st century is going to unfold, because there's absolutely no doubt that China and India will eventually emerge as the world's number one and number two economies. This is, as I've always said, a return to the natural order of things, because from the year 1 to the year 1820, for 1800, after the last 2000 years, the two largest economies of the world were always those of China and India. And clearly, how they interact is going to make a huge difference to our world. Unfortunately, in recent times, much of the public discourse has been on the negative side of the ledger about the challenges and differences between India and China at the border. These are all real problems. But today in our discussion with Girija Pandey, we hope that we can also study the positive side of the ledger and the great potential that the two economies have for cooperating with each other. So I'm going to begin the discussion by asking Girija a very broad question. How does he see the prospects for growth in both China and India in the coming years?
Thank you, Kishore. Glad to be here. This is a subject very close to my heart, because I have built a business in China and India, so I think it's a
great
story.
How many years did you live in China?
10 years. I used to build. I never lived there, but I used to spend huge amounts of time there.
Wow, yeah.
Built a business in 5 or 7 cities of China. So I think we must understand that the long-term view of the growth trajectory of both is quite good. The difference is that there are two differences. One, China is 5 times the size of India in terms of GDP, nearly $17.5 trillion versus $3.5 trillion. So that's one factor. The other factor is, as China starts decelerating because it is at another level of economic growth, India starts accelerating. So the growth in India will accelerate and the growth in China will decelerate, and it becomes more and more developed economy. So I think we have to keep this in mind. I have always seen that Chinese started the reform in 1978 and the India started reform in 1992. That difference of 12, 13 years from 78 is exactly where the difference is now. So if you plot the curve and shift India by 12 to 13 years, you will find exactly the same growth pattern. So it's quite interesting to see the difference within. So really, the kind of government doesn't matter in economics, if you see that's what has happened. So that's one part of the story. The second is that, you know, to catch up, the Chinese have developed a very powerful manufacturing base. It's probably the world has never seen anything as efficient and as productive as China has done with a lot of clusters. It's a remarkable story. India is trying to build it, but it is not there as yet. And India will probably catch up in light manufacturing initially. And also, it will become a little bigger exporter than it is. China is the largest exporter-importer of nearly $3.7 trillion a year. That's the export-import trade figure of China. And that's probably the largest in the world. India has a demographic dividend on its side with average age of 28 years, whereas China is now 39 years. So China will grow old, as they say, before it gets rich. India has a demographic dividend, but if it is not reskilled fast enough, it can be quite problematic. So that's where I think the difference in worker productivity, for example, an Indian worker roughly is 60% as productive as Chinese. So, you know, there's a difference in productivity because of the skill level. So the challenge in this is when you build a manufacturing base is how quickly can you scale up? And I recall going to one of the big skilling centers in China many years ago in Tianjin. We used to have a joint venture there. And it was like a huge, we had to go in a jeep through that whole system.
Wow.
Yes. It was so big.
Massive, yeah.
Thousands of lathes and milling machines and conference room to train and upskill people what they did. I think many people forget what skilling requires. That kind of resources for people to be brought in. So I think that's where I think you will find. Now, both of them have a growing middle class, and that will be the biggest middle class of a billion plus, as everyone knows. If both of them grow, the Asian manufacturing base strengthens because China is getting more costlier. India can produce cheaper than China because of the nature of the economy. So I think the world will see a bigger manufacturing base of both countries. And as both of them produce more cost effectively, inflation will be lower. That's where the benefit to the globe will be for both of them, manufacturing for the world. And you will see a benefit on inflation. That's what Chinese did. In the last 20 years, we saw inflation down because China was producing very efficiently. And when you have more growth and less focus on geopolitics, we will see more trade between the two. Of course, we have to be cautious. Both of them have to grow sustainably. Otherwise, the world can see a bigger problem. So let me stop here.
Yes. Well, you're, I must say you've described very, very well the relative strengths and weaknesses of the Chinese and Indian economies and their potential. And I agree with you that the potential is enormous and India can eventually catch up. However, at the same time, if one had to point to one significant difference between China and India, the Chinese leaders decided early on that the best way to jumpstart the Chinese economy was to plunge into the ocean of globalization. And as you know, the China joined WTO and then followed that up by signing free trade agreements with ASEAN, I think with South Korea, if I'm not mistaken, and others. And as a result of that, China's trade just exploded, you know. And to give a concrete example of how it has exploded, in the year 2000, China's trade with ASEAN was only $40 billion, whereas ASEAN's trade with US was $135 billion, three times as large, more than three times larger. But by 2022, even though U.S. trade with ASEAN had grown to $380 billion, China's trade with ASEAN had grown to $975 billion. $975 billion. That's amazing. Well, it shows, therefore, that China realizes that the way to grow its economy is to try and open its economy and integrate with the rest of the world. Now, India, as we know, has been a bit more hesitant and, as we know, was reluctant to sign the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. I know that you have personally advocated that India should have joined. How would you persuade, let's say, if an Indian audience is listening to us, how would you persuade an Indian audience that it's in India's national interest to join something like the RCEP?
So there are two questions which are really have to be addressed. One is this perennial issue which comes up. I mean, Chinese are great traders. They have a great export capability and they developed it over many years. Why is there such a large trade deficit? Because everything starts with this long-term trade deficit that India suffers. And in fact, the trade deficit keeps increasing, ironically, despite all the measures taken. So why does this the trade deficit happen? Because that has a direct bearing on the RCEP negotiations.
You're right.
And the reason is, and we've written about this in our book, is that there is a structural deficit. India exports minerals, cotton, lower value items, imports from China, manufactures, components, electronic components, which are higher value
and
items.
Power plants.
Sometimes power plants, sometimes all kinds of components of that machinery. So you will consistently have this unless India becomes a big exporter. In fact, India does not even export enough to pay for its oil, runs deficits on the oil account. So India needs to do something about its exports in general. It has nothing to do only with China. And the Indian exports are cotton, ferrous metals, cement sometimes, oils, whereas they are exporting machinery, electronic components, and all kinds of things. So as India picks up growth, actually it'll suck in more imports. And people will go where it is cheapest and the quality is okay. So the Chinese become the natural market for importing. Unless you sort of diversify, Indians diversify to some other markets, it's going to be a difficult issue. And it becomes a little politicized when it shouldn't. The trade deficit is an economic problem, not a political problem. Now, one of the things that the Indians have been saying that the two most competitive industry that India has, globally competitive industry, is IT and IT-enabled services, clearly globally competitive, and pharma, again, globally competitive. Now, they have not had any success in China. So the Indian side consistently complains about the tariff barriers, non-tariff barriers, which are put in these procurement of these services and goods. And their view is that it's not in favor of India. So this is the debate that always happens. What can we export, which you do not allow us to do? Now, pharma, as you probably know, is a very big business for India. It's the fourth largest by volume in the world. It exports to 108 countries, formulations. But ironically, it is dependent on API from China. So the 80% of the bulk drugs, active ingredients come from China, but the formulations grow from India. So this is a classic synergy between the two.
Mm-hmm. So the higher also, the formulation... This also contributes to the trade deficit, right?
That's right. The higher the formulation, the higher the bulk deficit import, bulk drugs import. Clearly, long-term sustainable relationship needs to get balanced. So I think there is a view that both sides have to look at balancing. But it will not go into balance all the time because of the nature of two economies at this point of time. The Chinese costs are rising. The rest of the world offshores to India in terms of IT services. And this includes non-English speaking countries, Japan, Korea, European countries. They all so is the language is not an issue in the offshoring of IT services. China is running short of people. And it is running short and it is costlier. So to make their companies more productive, Indian IT, like it has done for the Western countries and Japan, can actually have a very big role. Like manufacturing from China and parts from China can have a very big role in the Indian manufacturing process. So I think if we look at it purely economically, there is a synergy which both can utilize. And we just need to get over this and understand it from an economic and commercial point of view rather than anything else. So coming to RCEP.
Just before you jump into RCEP, very quickly on the trade point, you're right to point out to the structural deficit in the trade relationship. But there's also a sort of important psychological point here that when you open up your economy, you do get creative destruction. But what Zhu Rongji did when China joined the WTO is that he used the external pressures of creative destruction to make the Chinese economy more competitive by removing some of the uncompetitive industries. And in some ways, India may be doing itself a favor by allowing more creative destruction of its less competitive industries so that they can switch to the more competitive ones. Now, is there any constituency in India that argues for that?
If you look at 1991-92 in India, when India was suffering a huge balance of payment crisis, IMF had to be called in. Narasimha Rao, who was then the prime minister, opened India. And quite a few industries went under. Mm-hmm. Not to the same scale as what Zhu Rongji did, but a huge restructuring happened in all kinds of industry where they were suddenly faced with lower tariffs and foreigners coming in. And the benefit of that has been the growth of India for the last 20 years. So that opening up to the globe in 1991-92 is what created this huge growth. Now, I think we now not need to do a second round of reform where we open up again. So yeah, India has also seen a restructuring of the industry. But it has not been to the same scale as what the Chinese did. Chinese came into it very suddenly and they had to join the WTO. India is a founding member of WTO. But Chinese joined in 2000 and they had to do it much faster. And they have the capability to do it much faster. So India has done that, but it needs to do much more.
So now let's turn to the RCEP.
So RCEP was very surprising and disappointing. Personally, I think
the Indian decision, not to join the RCEP was disappointing.
Because they were in it actually for a long time. Till they pulled out.
The other countries held back the conclusion of RCEP to give India time to join.
Yes, in fact, they have been, in a way, kind enough to actually give an option to India to join whenever they like.
Yes.
So there is an option which India has, and I hope someone takes it one day. But I think the fear has been the swamping of the Indian manufacturing by Chinese companies / goods. That fear is sort of innate and inherent. There are also domestic lobbies, which obviously don't like the idea. But India historically has not signed many FTAs. The first FTA it actually signed was with Singapore, and then SICA 1 and SICA 2, and then with ASEAN. And most of the people you talk to tend to think that those FTAs with ASEAN really didn't give India any benefit. It was a one-way street. That is a debate that goes on within India. And so there is a reluctance to sign in any FTA. So this is not only an RCEP problem. It's a problem generally with doing this. You know, in economics, we call it the nascent industry argument. You know, you have to give nascent industry some time. But I mean, India has taken 50 years to develop these industries. So the nascent industry argument advantage is sometimes overplayed. But the good news is that they have started signing FTAs. I think that is a major step. I know for the rest of the world who sign FTAs quite often, especially in Asia, this is not a big thing. But I think they've signed with UAE, they've signed with Australia, England is on the cards, UAE, EU is on the cards. So they are starting to go down and realize, because India has traditionally been export pessimistic. We can't compete. Then the IT industry showed it. Then the pharma industry showed it. And as you in your book many times have said, the Indians compete everywhere. Why can't they compete in this? So two industries are very clearly shown that India competes.
I must say the export pessimism is a very strange thing, because if you look at how Indians compete in the most advanced economies in the world, especially in the United States of America, the one ethnic group that has got the highest per capita income of any ethnic group in the most competitive human laboratory in the world, which is the United States, is the ethnic Indian community.
True.
So Indians actually are born to compete. You know, in my case, I'm ethnically a Sindhi. My first cousins are competing in Suriname, Guyana, Nigeria, Texas, Florida, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and they do very well.
Yeah, so I think that's what has come through, that many of the industries, these two specifically I mentioned, have competed in the world very aggressively. So it can compete. With RCEP not there, I can see two problems. One is that if you have manufacturing to move into India, The suppliers are going to be all over Asia, including China. Okay. And this is the China plus one strategy that people are talking about. So Apple has moved, others are moving, right? Now, if they come in, as you know, electronic and many of the auto component industries have components all over in different. So there are tier one suppliers, tier two suppliers, and then the things keep moving back and forth, as we have seen in Singapore, where we have electronic industry, component industry as well. When they start moving in into an area outside the free trade zone, then you have bigger challenges because there are no uniform rules. There are no tariff similarities. So India will have a disadvantage in the chain of electronic and auto components because of not being RCEP. So that's the one disadvantage. The second disadvantage is for the exporters of India. If they want to now sell to ASEAN and the wider Asia of RCEP, either they sell, set up a unit in ASEAN or somewhere in Asia and then produce and sell with all the, you know, the percentage of content issues. So the Indian exporters are disadvantaged, and the companies which are going in with a China plus one strategy will suddenly find that how do I handle my tier two, tier three suppliers who are sitting in Indonesia or Malaysia or Philippines or Vietnam or China. So I think that's where the RCEP will start hitting India. But as
is
I said...
Is it possible, you think, Girija, that perhaps what India could do, this would take a sort of case study approach and maybe study one case study of a country that has probably in many ways deeper reservations about China than India does, which is Vietnam. Vietnam has been had a 2,000-year relationship with China. In fact, it was occupied by China for 1,000 years.
Yes.
And I can completely understand why the Vietnamese are deeply concerned about, you know, the challenge from China. But despite that, the Vietnamese have also very cleverly leveraged China to boost their own economic growth and development. And now you have this amazing situation where in 2022, the China-Vietnam trade stood at US$235 billion. And a lot of it, by the way, is from companies that are investing in what is called a China plus one strategy. So they're investing in China, they want to invest on one part outside China and invest in Vietnam. But the advantage of investing in Vietnam is that Vietnam is both a member of the RCEP and the CPTPP. So that means Vietnam, if you manufacture in Vietnam, you have access to many more markets. So it is interesting that Vietnam shares in many ways the concerns that India has about China, but is at the same time able to leverage China to grow its economy very fast. Is that case study?
Vietnam? I mean, there are a lot of countries who have differences with China on politics or whatever. But economics is separate, and they actively trade with them and attract investment from China. And Vietnam has done very, very effectively, and it's a classic example. But we will see it across ASEAN. ASEAN has issues with China, but yet they are there, and so does EU and US. Hmm. I mean, who could have bigger problems than the American Chinese, which all of us read about? And also, if you look at you talk about the 1,000-year history of Vietnam. China and India never have had a fault line historically other than the last 60 years when the colonials drew a boundary line. Religion went back and forth. Faiyan came to India, Journey to the West, which every Chinese child reads, and every Chinese realizes where the Buddhism came from. There is no fault line historically between the two countries. It is the last 60 years of colonial boundaries, right? Which are the challenges. So, India opened up to China when Rajiv Gandhi went. And then between the time President Xi Jinping visited India in 2011 to 2019, 16 agreements were signed, trade agreements, all kinds of agreements. And India and China decided to be the preferred development partners to build on this relationship.
What does that term mean?
I think they were looking at economic growth, more synchronizing their economies and trade and investments. And you know, a lot of Chinese companies at that stage came in. So there are about 103 Chinese companies operating in India and similar numbers operating in China. So all this happened and people started investing in either. So trade and investments are part of the same story, right? In between, of course, we've had some challenges, but India realizes the fact that the Chinese supply chain and the manufacturing base that it has created is something which all companies use. The global value chains, if have to move to India, like they have moved to Vietnam and Thailand and Malaysia. And my argument is that if you bring, American multinational, they will bring their tier two, tier three suppliers from China, naturally. Yes. But how else will you do this? So you can't on one side want the global value chain to shift and not have a better trade linkage. So I think it's a question of getting there.
Well, I must say, you raised two very, very important points that many people are not aware of. One is, unlike the longer China-Vietnam relationship, which has had a lot of friction and difficulties, the longer relationship between China and India overall has been a happy one. And it's only in the last 61 years, I guess now, after the 1962 border war, that you've had tensions as a result of a border that was driven by the colonial authorities. And also you mentioned an interesting point that every Chinese child reads about, this famous visit of this Chinese monk to India. So that being the case, is there a possibility of trying to enhance the what I call the people-to-people relationship between China and India by actually encouraging more Chinese tourists to come to India? And as we know, before COVID, Chinese were delivering the largest number of overseas tourists. It hit 130 million in 2019. And I suspect once all the restrictions on COVID are removed and once the flights are restored to China, then there'll be probably 200 or 300 million Chinese traveling outside China within the next decade or so. And one logical place for them to visit would be to go to India, since Buddhism was created in India. How do you assess that potential, and how welcoming will India be to getting maybe 50 million Chinese tourists?
Well, India has been trying to boost the tourism industry. It's a very, it generates a big multiplier. Tourism industry generates a huge multiplier of economic growth. We all know that. And India has been trying to build up the infrastructure. India needs to first build up the infrastructure for larger and larger tourist inflow, not just one country or the other. So hotels, airlines, visa systems, flights, all that has to be fixed. So that is a general issue of tourism. And there are some areas, and tourism has been growing steadily, but it's still small compared to these numbers. And every country has seen the benefits of Chinese tourists, Europe especially, where Chinese tourists have generated growth for many of those countries. So I think that part is very well understood. And of course, being the hub of the Buddhist circuit, as India calls it, you know, the whole circuit of Buddhist religious sites, is phenomenal. I mean, no one else has it. But I think at this point of time, the people-to-people contact is a sensitive issue. But I'm sure at some stage it will open up and there will be two-way. Similarly, the Indian tourists also started going on bigger and bigger numbers. And China is always a question for all of them. So I think it will happen. It should happen. But it takes time, especially once the trust comes back.
Yeah, I want to mention a very mischievous concept I've invented called the new CIA. And the new CIA doesn't stand for Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America. It stands for China, India, and ASEAN. And, you know, we were talking about the middle class populations, just the explosion of the middle class populations of the China, India, ASEAN is absolutely amazing. Yeah, the combined population of China, India, and ASEAN is roughly 3.5 billion people. Out of these 3.5 billion people, you only had 150 million people in middle class in the year 2000. But that number has exploded to 1.5 billion by 2020. And it will rise even more to 2.5 billion by 2030. So in that sense, as India's middle class population grows, ASEAN's middle class population grows, China's middle class population grows, if you can create organic links between these three major middle class populations, that will give a huge boost to growth in Asia also.
This Asian middle class story will benefit the whole world, because the growth is going to happen here. it'll happen within the growing middle class. Whether it's in India, whether it's in China or ASEAN, they will all consume higher and higher levels of goods and services. And it is good for the rest of the world because the rest of the world doesn't seem to have anemic growth rates because they are at a developed level. So I think it's absolutely positive for the world to see such a large middle class and to encourage the formation of large middle class that is happening in this part of the world. I think China has already developed a large middle class. India is on the path to developing a large middle class. Ditto ASEAN, some of the bigger countries in ASEAN have the same issues. So I think the middle class will actually, in a way, increase trade, and the importance of trade and investments will become much more versus when they were not so big and they were being ignored. Now no one can ignore this middle class of Asia. And most of the companies are, you know, positioning themselves for, whether they are Indian companies, Chinese companies, foreign companies, ASEAN companies, all positioned. If you talk to any boardroom, this is the debate that goes on. How to access, build brands, delivery, logistics. That's what we talk about most of the time.
Yeah, in addition to ASEAN, I want to mention, because India has developed close ties with ASEAN, but India has also now joined several organizations which also involve China. One is, of course, BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, which, by the way, seems to be a growing industry. More and more countries want to join BRICS. And at the same time, India, I think, has also joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So do you see that these other organizations can also help to build bridges between India and China?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I think the fact that India and China are both in it and have continued to be in it is a very positive sign. Because all these also have an economic dimension anyway. The BRICS have an economic dimension. All of them have a very large economic dimension along with the strategy dimension. So it certainly helps for people meeting. We just had, I think in India, they were holding the Shanghai Cooperation Council meeting recently. Then BRICS will happen. In fact, India is hosting both this year. So yes, I think it's like G20. You know, the more you meet, the more trade and economics get done and the less of politics comes in the way. I'm glad no one has withdrawn from it. They're all, in fact, more and more countries are wanting to join it. So it's obviously I think it's a story of the global south that is now emerging and the trade between the global south. It's like the Chinese trade with Asia, intra-Asia trade is much more now than the trade across the Pacific.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned also the G20 because I happen, as you know, Indonesia was the host of G20 last year. And I happened to have breakfast with President Jokowi just a few days before the G20 meeting, in the very site of the G20 meeting. And I told President Jokowi that the world would be very grateful to him if he could organize a good meeting between President Joe Biden and President Xi Jinping. And his reply to me was, "Don't worry, I've given them the nicest room in Bali for the meeting." And of course, they had a good meeting. Unfortunately, it got derailed by Balloon Gate. But in the case of India, since India is hosting the G20 meeting this year in September, I believe, do you think this might be an appropriate opportunity? Perhaps, I noticed that you mentioned earlier that President Xi and Prime Minister Modi had several bilateral meetings between 2011 and 2019. Do you think it's possible to maybe organize a restart of the good bilateral meetings that the two leaders used to have before we had the border skirmish in Galwan in June 2020?
Difficult to say, as I don't track politics. But clearly, India is the host. So as a host country, you have to be more willing to look after all kinds of guests, all the guests. So I think I would suspect that's what should happen. But who knows?
Well, I must say that in our discussion today, I'm glad that we have pointed out that there are many areas in which there could be positive synergies between China and India. I wonder if you want to add anything else before we close in about 5 minutes on any other issues or dimensions that you think
can be
explored for further strengthening.
We have to find a way of collaborating economically and commercially. We have to really look for it. It's not far to look because both are growing economies with pretty sophisticated people on both sides. So it's not difficult for them to see the mutual benefits. So if you look at the Chinese side, A, they are big exporters and India is a huge market. So they can't afford not to be in this market. B, they have a large program of overseas infrastructure financing. Their cost structures are high. India can join in to some of those projects and reduce the cost effectively. So you can actually
So China and India can cooperate in building a road in Africa, for example.
These are big numbers. I mean, Chinese have nearly built $1 trillion plus in the projects that they have done, right? So there's opportunities of overseas collaboration with the Indian construction firms, right? On the other side, you have this whole issue of India needs to get some of the Chinese technologies and sustainabilities, renewables, EVs, battery technology, robotics, because China is on a path to becoming a more and more innovative countries with higher levels of technology, because they are competing with the Americans, right? So India can benefit from that, those technologies, which are probably easier to get and are cheaper than what you would get traditionally from the West. China needs to reduce its cost, and it has a manpower shortage issue sooner or later. India is now the largest population in the world, as it has overtaken China, can provide the heft to keep the Chinese engine running in some parts and reduce their costs. So I think there is a good synergy which is possible. Both of them need to sort of understand the mutual benefit that comes out of trading and investing in each other. And I think commerce normally trumps politics sooner or later. And I just hope that one of these, that happens sooner than later.
Well, I think it'll be commerce. And I'm glad you also introduced the climate change dimension, because actually for many years, there was very close cooperation between China and India in all the major climate change global conferences, because climate change is happening today, not just because of the new flows of greenhouse gas emissions from China and India, which are the largest new producers of greenhouse gas emissions, but it's also because of the stock of greenhouse gas emissions that the Western industrialized countries have put up in the atmosphere since the Western Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. So clearly, it's the moral burden is greater on the richer developed countries to contribute more, but they're trying to shift the burden to China and India. So this is one area where I think there's common interest for China and India to collaborate with each other, not just in global negotiations, but also in trying to find effective, cost-efficient solutions to dealing with climate change. But this is why it's actually very important for the dialogue between China and India to resume.
Certainly on the climate change, there is no debate at all for anyone. These are going to be the potentially the two largest emitters, and they need to work together, get the technologies right, get the renewables going. Mm. And I think both have done quite well, actually. India has done quite well in renewables, as of course is China.
Yes.
So it's going well. Mm.
But I want to conclude now by sort of getting you to elaborate just a little bit more on your point, which is another optimistic point. In the long run, commerce trumps politics, you said.
it happens everywhere. I mean, it happens everywhere. It's not just India, China. When you allow private sector to start working and finding the benefits, then that starts taking a precedent. That normally is what we have seen. You've just talked about Vietnam. You've talked about Japan and China. You've talked about US and China. Politics are there, but that doesn't stop the flow of trade and investments going on. The American companies invest in China still, and so does other parts of the world. I think we just have to see it happening in other countries for the Indian and Chinese to both realize that there is a value in this.
Well, I hope many people in the commercial sectors, especially the people in the private firms in India, will be listening to this program, India and China, to understand that in addition to the negative dynamic, which is real in some areas within China and India, there's potential for a very positive dynamic also within China and India. And since our goal of the Asian Peace Program is to try and promote peace in Asia, it's especially critical that the two giants of Asia, China and India, maintain a peaceful relationship with each other.
If I just end up in the last chapter of our book, we actually envisaged where this relationship would go. We said that imagine a day when in a conference hall in Beijing, an Indian pharma company would sign an agreement to do research on a molecule, cancer molecule. On the same day, the Chinese high-speed railway would be signing in a CII conference room in India, a high-speed rail technology transfer.
Yeah,
well, that would bring the best of both.
Well, I would say it's always good to end with a lovely dream. And that's a great dream to have in mind. And I hope that 10 years from now, you and I will witness these two events. So thank you very much, Girija, for joining us. And I want to conclude by saying that the Asian Peace Talks podcast is produced here by two extremely helpful young people in the Asian Research Institute. They are Dr. Varigonda Kesavachandra and Kristen Tang. And this podcast series is released by the Asian Peace Program, housed in the Asia Research Institute of the National University of Singapore. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, and Sheshe.